Well, let's invite Dr. Andrew Miss. He will talk about disc edema in a young man.
So I'd like to thank Dr. Bernier for inviting me today. I was a resident in McGill when Dr. Bernier first came to Montreal, and I think this meeting is a wonderful and fitting tribute to your teaching and mentorship skills. So I'd like to present a case of a young man that presented back in September of 2004. He was a 17-year-old thin male who presented with a new onset of mild constant headaches that had begun in May of 2004. He also had intermittent horizontal diplopia, transient visual obscurations, and mild tension in his neck. He'd had no recent weight changes, and he was on no medications at all. He denied any vascular tinnitus, and he had a history of occasional nasal cocaine abuse, but was otherwise healthy. At presentation, he had normal color vision. His visual acuity was 20/20 minus in both eyes. His pupils were equal and normally reactive. He had a small esotropia in the distance, but had full ductions and versions, and the remaining cranial nerves were all normal. He did have striking bilateral optic disc edema, and I'm sorry I don't have clinical photographs to show you from the initial visit. His visual field testing revealed enlarged blind spots. He had a CT of his head performed with and without contrast, and this was entirely normal. He also had an MRI of the brain, the cervical spine, and an MR venogram, which were all normal, apart from a small anterior portion of the superior sagittal sinus. A lumbar puncture was also performed, and the opening pressure was 280 to 300 millimeters of water, normal being less than 250 millimeters. Otherwise, his CSF sugar and protein were normal, and his CSF cytology was negative. Here's a photograph or an MR venogram of a sagittal of the brain showing the... We can do it this way. Just showing the anterior portion of the superior sagittal sinus here is very diminished compared to the posterior portion, and this was thought to be just congenital in nature. So the diagnosis at that time was an atypical case of idiopathic intracranial hypertension, and the patient was started on oral Diamox at a dose of 1 to 2 grams per day. He had side effects from the Diamox. He felt faint, had diarrhea, and he was non-compliant with the treatment and was eventually lost to follow-up. He didn't return again until 2 years later, in September of 2006, now complaining of a return of headaches, markedly decreased vision, and a visual acuity that was 20/200 in each eye. He had significant disc edema and some pallor as well. Here's his clinical photographs. His visual fields were severely constricted in both eyes. We did an infused CT of his head, which was normal. A CT venogram showed no venous sinus thrombosis. A lumbar puncture was repeated and showed an elevated opening pressure of 340 millimeters of water. His CSF glucose and protein were again normal, and CSF cultures were also negative. Again, the diagnosis of idiopathic intracranial hypertension was entertained, and he was restarted on Diamox at a dose of 1 gram per day. His vision improved to 20/30 in the right eye and 20/100 in the left. However, his visual fields were essentially unchanged. He therefore underwent bilateral optic nerve sheath fenestrations, and the operating surgeon described an escape of clear CSF during the procedure. The excised portions of the optic nerve sheath, I'm sorry, I don't have the pathology, but they were just reported as having dense collagenous connective tissue and no other abnormalities. His vision didn't really change much after the procedure, although his optic disc edema did improve significantly. Here's his post-optic nerve fenestration visual fields, which are really not much better. By November of 2006, he had stopped taking his Diamox. His vision was again decreased at 20/400 in the right eye and 20/100 in the left. His optic disc edema had again recurred. So a second optic nerve fenestration was repeated in the right eye, and there was no CSF egress from the second window. He was then maintained on Diamox 2 grams per day. And in December of 2006, a repeat lumbar puncture was again performed, and this showed a decreased CSF glucose, increased CSF protein, RBCs were seen, and the total nucleated cell count of 26 times 10 to the 6 per liter was also noted. Most of the cells, three-quarters, were normal lymphocytes, and about one-quarter were abnormal lymphocytes. And these are GEAM-sustained CSF cytologies. So here at low power, you can see a number of red blood cells. You can see a population of normal-appearing lymphocytes, but also a population of large atypical-looking lymphocytes. Here's a slightly higher population, again showing the larger lymphocytes and abnormal-looking lymphocytes with some mitotic figures, pleomorphism. Again, a higher power magnification. And again, very abnormal-looking cells. And some had even prominent nucleoli as well. This flow cytometry of the CSF revealed a monoclonal lambda population. It expressed CD19, CD20, HLA-DR, CD10, and CD71. There was no expression of CD5 or CD23, so they were felt to be of germinal center cell origin. A staging workup was performed, and this included an MRI of the brain and cervical spine with gadolinium, a CT of the neck, chest, abdomen, and pelvis, a testicular ultrasound, and a bone marrow biopsy all were negative. So his diagnosis at that time was primary leptomeningeal lymphoma. He completed 8 courses of high-dose intrathecal methotrexate chemotherapy, and in September of 2007, his LP was negative for lymphoma cells. His opening pressure, however, was still high at 315, and he underwent a VP shunt in November of 2007. His vision, he hasn't been seen for about a year or so, but his vision is still, at his last visit, was still poor, measuring 2200 in the right eye and 2400 in the left, and both optic discs were pale. So primary leptomeningeal lymphoma was originally described by Lachance in 1991. It's a subset of primary CNS lymphoma. Primary CNS lymphoma accounts for about 1 to 2% of intracranial tumors, whereas primary leptomeningeal lymphoma accounts for about 7% of primary CNS lymphomas. Primary leptomeningeal lymphoma makes up about less than 1% of all lymphomas. Most cases, 90%, are a diffuse large B-cell type, 10% are low-grade T-cell or Burkitt lymphomas. The malignant cells are found within and around the meninges. There's no invasion of parenchymal tissue. In Lachance's series, most of the cases were in middle-aged or elderly people, though there have been some case reports in children and young adults since then. There's no sex predilection. Often there will be a sudden onset of clinical symptoms with a rapid progression, though there have been case reports of indolent courses where patients had prodromal symptoms for 3 and 7 years before diagnosis. The symptoms can include a headache, nausea, vomiting, diplopia, visual loss, confusion, hydrocephalus, seizures, dysarthria, decreased hearing, paraparesis, facial weakness, cranular palsies, polyradiculopathies, and caudate equina syndrome. CSF aspirates can be normal, but about 80% of patients will show a low glucose or elevated protein on the CSF, and 10 to 66% of patients will have a positive cytology. A cytospin preparation is helpful in getting a positive cytology. Immunocytochemistry and PCR may also be helpful. MRI with gadolinium is the neuroimaging study of choice. It can show a diffuse or nodular thickening of the nerve roots. There will often be post-gadolinium enhancement observed. MRI imaging is not sensitive or specific enough, however, to make a definitive diagnosis. Here's a patient who had a caudate equina syndrome from primary leptomeningeal lymphoma, and the first image is a T2-weighted axial MR at the level of L3, and it shows thickening of the of multiple nerve roots, and then all of the nerve roots enhanced with gadolinium here. So some diagnostic criteria have been proposed for primary leptomeningeal lymphoma. They include no prior or subsequent diagnosis of systemic lymphoma, no prior organ transplantation, immunosuppressive therapy, systemic or intrathecal antineoplastic drug therapy, or AIDS. Patients cannot have any parenchymal or subependymal CNS lesions on CT. They have to have negative staging for systemic lymphoma, and they have to demonstrate malignant lymphocytes either in the CSF or in the arachnoid membrane on meningeal biopsy. The treatment options, early corticosteroids may cause initial regression in about 40% of patients. Near axis irradiation has been used in some patients, but whole brain radiotherapy is not recommended as it leads to really severe and delayed neurotoxicity. Chemotherapy has also been used both intravenously, intrathecally, or with an Ommaya reservoir, and agents that have been used include high-dose methotrexate, cytarabine, and Rituxan. There have been some treatment successes reported with this condition, but the prognosis is generally poor, and the median survival is about 8 months. So I think some of the interesting aspects of this case is that our patient was initially diagnosed with idiopathic intracranial hypertension and had a really chronic and indolent course, which unfortunately led to legal blindness. There have been only two other cases of primary leptomeningeal lymphoma presenting as idiopathic intracranial hypertension, and though repeat lumbar punctures were performed, no abnormal cells were initially identified on the cytology. So in conclusion, there's little mention of this condition in the ophthalmic literature. I think it's something that we need to think about. It's an important diagnostic consideration in patients with atypical idiopathic intracranial hypertension who have disc swelling, focal neurological symptoms, and ongoing visual loss. And repeat serial lumbar punctures where you demand CSF cytology are really critical to making the diagnosis. Thank you.
Any questions for Dr. Miss?
I'd like to make two comments. First of all, I'd like to thank Andrew and Dr. Miss for being here with us. We have been friends for many, many years. Has been interested in pathology and has been participating in the Canadian Ocular Pathology Society for many years, always presenting great cases. It's an honor and privilege to have you, and please feel free to join the society. You're one of us, and I think it's great to have you. It's a very interesting case because when we did a study comparing, and we had only one case of diffused leptomeningeal B-cell lymphoma with the more classical brain lymphomas or lymphomas with the nodular areas in the brain, plus the classical cases of lymphomas of the retina with subsequent CNS involvement. In the cytogenetic studies, the ones that start in the eye and then eventually goes to the brain in a multicentricity type of fashion, they're the most malignant. They're all large B-cell, and they're all non-Burkitt large B-cell high-grade lymphomas. Now, because we have only one leptomeningeal, it's very rare, we didn't know how to put that in. But in our study, I think we had 12 cases, the leptomeningeal was the most aggressive cytologically. And that maybe explains why it's diffuse without any nodular structures and doesn't affect the eye in the same fashion that the ocular or CNS would affect. I think it's very important what you said, bilateral disc edema, in particularly in younger patients, we should think of possible malignancies, particularly in the CNS. And it's completely different from the primary intraocular retinal lymphoma because that affects female patients much more often patients with either previous radiation, or immunosuppression or immunodepression, and in particular it's bilateral with uveitic presentation. And those are patients that present with uveitis. They never present with a disc edema, and is the only find that we had in the eye. Great case, and it's extremely rare.
Thank you, because it was a fantastic case. And as a matter of fact, I have a patient at this time with a similar symptomology. And the question is, she is a young patient, we don't know what is the diagnosis. She is losing vision. She does not have intracranial hypertension. And my question is, it's normal to have intracranial hypertension in these cases, or is rare?
It's very rare. I think there's only been three cases where that's, ours is the third case in the literature that we could find, that this was the way the patients presented. But I think in a case where you have a patient who may have intracranial idiopathic intracranial hypertension that's atypical and doesn't meet the criteria. For instance, it's a male, young patient, thin, then it's something that you should consider as a diagnosis.
And second question, if the tests are negative, what is the test to do? Because she is losing vision, she had swelling the optic disc. What is the test in order to rule out this kind of situation?
I think if you can see definite nerve root uptake on MRI, I think that can be helpful if there's involvement elsewhere in the CNS. And I think really that just repeats lumbar punctures, and because we did 3 lumbar punctures before a positive one actually showed up. So if there's a high clinical suspicion of it, I think repeat lumbar punctures with cytospin of the CSF for analysis and is important.
Thank you.
Let me make one comment about lumbar puncture, because I think it's a very, very good question. If you do lumbar puncture and you get a positive cytological result, that's a malignant tumor. However, sometimes we do that in our patients with malignant lymphomas of the brain and the eye. And what happens is, comes as negative. Let's stop for a minute and think about the word negative. Negative for malignant cells doesn't make a normal lumbar puncture. Meaning, if you have more than 5 cells of any nature, particularly more than 10, your lumbar puncture is abnormal. And one indicator of a CNS involvement of lymphoma or primary CNS of primary retinal lymphoma is the fact that sometimes the lumbar puncture doesn't come with malignant cells, but comes with a high percentage of T lymphocytes. And what the T lymphocytes are doing there? The T lymphocytes are reacting because of the presence of a mass, of a B lymphocytic infiltration. Then if you find T lymphocytes, reactive T cells that are not malignant, is an indicator for you to repeat LPs until you find the cytology. It's much more common that the first cytologic examination being negative and you only be able to make the diagnosis second or third time than all the way around. Then an abnormal LP is a flag for you to repeat the examination because you're going to find cytological atypia.
Thank you very much, Dr. Miss. I was wondering if you have any theories on what actually causes the increased intracranial hypertension in these patients. The mechanism is probably different from your idiopathic type, but are there any theories as to why?
In my readings, I never came across anyone suggesting a theory for that. In terms of how the lymphocytes get into the CSF, there were some theories that somehow they get through the subarachnoid space and originate there. But in terms of why the patients develop, this patient was very atypical in terms of the primary leptomeningeal lymphoma presentation and that they presented with idiopathic intracranial hypertension. And so it's hard to know.